Hi everyone, it's Luke Miller Callahan. I'm the founder of GrowAction.com, the pro action hub for true leaders just like you, where we're showcasing real change throughout the world. Now today I'm here with Derek Jensen. He's a prolific writer, speaker, and activist. He's the author of Endgame and a myriad of other great titles. And today he's joining me to talk about his latest, Dreams. Let's get into the program. All right. Well, I'm here with you, Derek Jensen, and we're talking about your book, Dreams, among whatever else comes. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the time. Really excited to be talking to you. Why don't you go ahead and tell me about Dreams and your work there?
Well, for years, I've had wanted to write a book about where dreams come from and who the muse is, and about the relationship between dreaming and waking realities. And I'd always put that off because it seemed that with the world being killed, why would I write a book about dreams? It seems like a fairly trivial topic in some ways. And then I was thinking about it, and I realized that I believe part of the reason that this culture is killing the planet, one of many reasons, is that it devalues messages from the places that dreams come from. And, you know, I've written in many books about how the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor. They generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And so, from an indigenous perspective, I mean, the indigenous have generally believed that trees are just as real and sentient as humans, and salmon are just as real and sentient as humans, and there is no sort of Christian hierarchy projected onto the natural world. But it's not just that. In addition, there's generally indigenous peoples have, I have never heard of an atheist indigenous culture. And instead, many indigenous peoples would have relationships with ancestors, with various spirits, whatever you want to call them. And so this book, and you know, I've written in many of my books about how I believe that dreams actually come from someone who gives them to us, as opposed to dreams being simply, messages from the unconscious. And how the muse is an actual being who writes the books that I then, who gives me the words for the books that I then handwrite or that I type up. And this is actually, it's only actually in the last about 300 to 400 years that even Westerners have believed that the muse is merely unconscious, you know, energy from your unconscious. Up until 300 to 400 years ago, even in the West, people believed that muses were real.
Yeah.
And that a muse would help you create your art. And so what are the implications of living in this increasingly silenced world? I mean, if you remember, my book, Language Older Than Words, one of the central parts of it was that this notion that before you can exploit somebody, you have to silence them. And this culture is based on systematically ignoring the voices of non-humans, of women, children, of other races.
And about being the dominant frame.
Yeah, that's absolutely the dominant frame. And so this book sort of takes that a step further. I want to say one thing and then I'll be done with this.
No, for sure.
Or two things, actually. Yeah, one of them is, so this book then also extends that to this culture systematically devalues messages from other sides that could come to us through dreams. And how does that harm us? How does that cause us? How does that facilitate the destruction of the planet? And then one last thing is that, you know, in Endgame, I lay out a bunch of the premises of the book before the book starts. You know, civilization is not, can never be sustainable, blah, blah, blah. And there's one premise in there that I don't really believe. That's only one. And the premise I don't really believe, I say something about how we can't get help from other sides. This is our mess and we have to fix it up. And the reason I did that premise in Endgame is because I believe that people will basically use any excuse they can to not act.
Sure.
And so if I gave them the excuse of saying we may get help from the Great Mother or we may get help from, you know, some other beings, they say, well, fine. Well, then we don't need to do anything because, right, you know, the Great Mother's going to take care of all of it. I didn't want to give that excuse. But since I didn't entirely believe it, I needed to write a whole book about that. And can we find allies on other sides? How can they help? How can we help them is actually the real question.
Right.
So anyway, that's the genesis of that book.
Yeah. Now, where do you think this disconnect comes from? Where we start ruling out the muse and really like you talk about with this science-based community, we kind of disregard anything that we can't truly measure in our own understanding.
Where does it come from, personally or socially?
Both. I mean,
well, on a social level, I think it's been an evolution that's been happening for thousands of years. And one of the points that I make in the book is that I believe that science is the intellectual and spiritual heir of Christianity, really. Because one of the things that all the Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, one of the things they all have in common is this distant sky god.
Mm-hmm.
And monotheism, in that sense, did the real heavy lifting of removing the divinity from the earth and putting it out way, way out there somewhere.
Right.
And then that's the hard part. Once you have divinity removed from the earth, it's really not that big a deal to go ahead and just, you know, click out the lights out there.
Right.
So having already removed meaning from the earth, you know, it continued this trajectory. So there's a social level at which this, consistent unwillingness to listen to these other voices happens. I keep thinking of the line by Upton Sinclair. It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I think the same thing is true for entitlement. It's hard to make someone understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it.
Sure.
And I just got some hate mail a couple nights ago. I get hate mail a lot.
Yeah.
And I got hate mail a couple nights ago from some guy saying that, you know, my perspective's really stupid. My perspective's blah, blah, blah. And then there's the one note that was really telling, the one line, I'll see if I can find it real fast.
Yeah.
I save most of my hate mail in a folder called Weirdness.
I think that's how you know you're on the right track once you start getting hate mail.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, no, it's true.
It's not very fun though.
Well, it's all how you look at it.
Oh, here we go. I like electricity, water, food, clothing, and medicine. And so basically because he likes all of those, then that means that my analysis is meaningless. The fact that you like electricity, and what I didn't write back to him, but I was kind of tempted to write back and say, whether or not you like it has no bearing on whether it's sustainable. Electricity,
right,
for example.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, it doesn't take a cognitive giant to figure out that, you know, any way of living that's based on an extractive economy can't last.
Yeah, exactly. Scraping the bottom of the barrel. Yeah.
But the reason that people keep pretending that it will is because, like this guy, they like the electricity.
Sure.
And sure, I like electricity just fine, but that doesn't mean that I have to believe that it's...
Doesn't mean you have to be short-sighted and understand that we could move beyond or look for different sources of electricity.
Or it doesn't mean that electricity can be sustainable, because it can't be, the industrial generation of it.
Oh, exactly.
So the point, okay, there's that. Another way that this happens is that, you'll notice another thing he said, and it's pretty amazing how consistent, I mean, how people can see the truth but then not see it. Listen to this. I like electricity, water, food, clothing, and medicine. Wow, interesting. So basically he is saying that, water comes from civilization. And it doesn't.
Yeah, right.
Actually. Water comes from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And food comes from the world. But that's part of how this has happened too, is that if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you're going to defend to the death the system that brings those two, because life depends on it.
Right.
And systematically, the system has insinuated itself in between us and the source of all life on the planet. And so we've come to believe
that we're dependent on it. We need it.
That we need it, and that it is actually the source of all life.
Yeah.
As opposed to real life being the source of all life. Oh, here's another one. Just a few days ago, I was watching Keith Olbermann, and they had on there they had this astronomer
mm-hmm.
talking about why we need to explore Mars. And he said, it will answer the most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? And I was thinking, I have an even more important question, which is he fucking crazy? Because, I'm sorry, how can you say that we're all alone when there are salmon and when there are trees?
Right.
And when there are, so there's where that comes from, is this incredible narcissism to believe that only we exist.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's extraordinary that they're destroying life on this planet as they're searching all over wondering, are we all alone? It's just, I mean, that's the entire problem right there.
It is. And it's a complete disconnect, right? It's just, it's us, and then maybe there's other things like us. And you know, it would be interesting if there was life on Mars, and if it resembled, say, salmon, what the finding would be, or if we could start valuing other creatures on this planet more.
I don't think they would. I think that what they would do is if they were, say that there were these creatures on Mars who had floppy ears and hopped around and had sort of buck teeth, I think probably people, what they would do is they would try to capture them and then test cosmetics on their eyes. You know, there's no reason to believe. We've already seen what happens. This is what happened when the Europeans arrived in North America. This is what happened when the Europeans arrived in Africa. It's just one more place to exploit. Why did they bomb the moon? They bombed the moon saying that they bombed the moon because they really wanted to stick this big penis up in the air and violate the moon. But the reason they gave is so that they could figure out how to mine the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, all they want to do is to continue to extract and exploit
resources
and throw this web of exploitation, or this net of exploitation, wider and wider.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's funny, you know, I guess you just have to laugh at the reasons that they come up with to hide that, right? Oh, we're going to invade Iraq because of this, not because of oil. You know, and hide that.
Well, you know, the one of the smartest things I ever read was this guy, Robert J. Lifton, wrote about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is not, in fact, an atrocity, but instead a good thing.
Yeah.
And so, for example, the Nazis weren't committing genocide. They were purifying the Aryan race.
Right.
And the dominant culture isn't killing the planet. It's developing natural resources. And the same is true on a personal level. I mean, I can't speak for you, but I have never in my life been an asshole. You know? Every time that I've ever done anything that if somebody else did it, I would consider them an asshole, I've had it fully rationalized.
Yeah.
And there's a great line the great discussion by R.D. Lang about how basically all of us, no matter how crazy we are, if you can understand somebody's experience, you can understand their behavior.
Yeah.
And so from Ted Bundy's perspective, his behavior made sense,
right,
which is not to excuse it. And
no,
he should still have been stopped, still have been killed. I got no problem with any of that.
Right.
But I'm saying that he didn't act nonsensically. It can make no sense to us,
but
from within his frame of mind. And Artie Lang gives this great example of that. That he has this, he takes this thing that this psychiatrist is saying, where there's the psychiatrist is standing in front of this audience, and there's this crazy woman on stage, this woman who's institutionalized and is just very crazy. And she's holding a piece of bread and she's walking back and forth on the stage going, mother, mother. And she's just doing that. And then the psychiatrist says, look, here's how insensate she is. And he pokes a pin in her forehead and then she doesn't even notice.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, he stands with his arms out wide and she stops right in front of him, doesn't say anything to him and starts, you know, wailing. And then after that, he grabs the bread from her and then she starts wailing again.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, okay, clearly this woman's crazy. But now let's turn this around and take the guy's behavior out of context. There's a woman who's just minding her own business. He steps in front of her.
Yeah.
He pokes her in the forehead with a pin.
Right.
He stops her from moving and he steals her bread.
Yeah.
This guy's crazy. And the point is that, you know, from Dick Cheney's perspective, what he does makes sense.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that his perspective is right. And it doesn't mean that he's not evil or insane. But these worldviews become coherent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like if you tie it back to this environmental movement, right? And you go and look at all these people in West Virginia, say, who are against stopping coal mining, right? Because it's their livelihood. They want to put food on the table. And people on the West Coast or environmentalists say, you're crazy. How can you be defending that? And then you look at it from their perspective and you see, I want to put food on the table for my family. I want to provide a good living. And this is how I know to do that, right? And then what I see you guys saying is, you want to take that away from me? You want to take away my ability to provide? Well, that's crazy. And I'm going to fight to the death, you know, my right to do this, to make money and provide a safe place for my family.
Well, and that's one of the problems is that people, that's one of the brilliant things about the system is, like any good abusive system, the system itself has made us dependent upon the very system that is exploiting us and everyone else.
Like you're saying, exactly.
And that's one of the ways that we've been painted into a very, very bad corner.
Sure. And that's where we need to really come up with creative solutions where to the coal miner, we can come in and say, listen, well, we have jobs waiting for you that are better and this is why.
One of the problems is that the propaganda machine of the corporate, corporate media makes all discussions of any of these issues really insane.
Mm-hmm.
And a great example of this, and I fought this a lot through the 90s when I was doing a lot of forest activism, and it was always presented in the corporate media as jobs versus owls, but that was always a lie because all through the 80s, the cut went up and the number of jobs went down. And it wasn't because the cut was going up. It wasn't because of spotted owls or anybody. It was because of raw log exports and automation. And no matter how many times we said that, we couldn't penetrate that worldview. We couldn't penetrate even for most of the loggers. A lot of the loggers knew that the timber companies were going to screw them over.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter. None of this mattered to discourse. And so there's this very serious disconnect from reality in all of these discussions. And it's the same thing. You can do study. I've just seen these studies. Study after study has shown that, first off, let's pretend that we're going to continue with coal mining, but it's not going to be mountaintop removal. There's actually more jobs with old-style coal mining than there is with mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who are really interested in jobs should be arguing for old underground mining.
Right.
They should be arguing against mountaintop removal. And then in addition, there's all sorts of studies showing that the communities that have mountaintop removal actually have higher rates of unemployment than the communities that don't. But this stuff never enters the discourse.
But I think,
and so there's a larger problem. There's a larger level of denial here at work. I mean, once again, it doesn't take a cognitive giant to figure out that if you are cutting off the top of a mountain and dumping all of that into streams, it's going to destroy your home.
It's just
not a hard concept.
Well, I guess we have to look at who they trust and who they listen to, right? And that's where the right-wing party is so impressive because they're two different, very different groups. You have the majority who are the labor class, like the blue-collar workers who are working hard and don't make much money, but really, really work hard for the money they make. And then you have this very elite group within them that are very, power-oriented, very money-oriented, and are very, very good at sales and at convincing people, because they obviously don't have the majority to make any policy, right? So they can influence these blue-collar workers. I mean, it's just incredible what they can do, right?
And this has been a really smart program on the part of the right and a really big mistake on the part of the left. I agree with you.
Yeah.
And part of what's going on is, like I said, a huge successful program on the right and a huge mistake on the left. And what this has to do with is morality.
Yeah.
But back in the 60s, the Republicans were very, very, they had a specific strategy. How can we get blue collar workers to vote against their own economic interests?
Yeah.
And they thought, just, you know, did focus groups, and they finally came up with a plan. And the plan was, they realized that a lot of them are Catholic. So what's the issue? The issue is going to be abortion.
Wow.
And so they pushed that issue. And this is true. I mean, my mom has a friend who's a fundamentalist Christian who consistently votes against her own interest, economic interest, specifically because of the issues of homosexuality.
Yeah.
And because she hates gays.
Sure.
And she hates gays because she's a fundamentalist Christian. And that's, okay, I'm not saying, okay, that's their successful campaign. And the way the left has really dropped the ball on this is by giving up morality to the right wing. And we should be saying that the Gulf oil spill wasn't a mistake, it was immoral. And right. We should be saying that mountaintop removal is immoral. And we also should be, I mean, one of the issues I do talk about some, a fair amount actually, is I think a place the left has really blown is on pornography. By, you know, quite often it's just a handful of radical feminists and then the Christian right who's against pornography.
Sure.
And I think that we're giving up a lot of, I mean, I think the nuclear family is really pretty harmful in general.
Yeah, it is.
I think that there are certain values of morality that we should be, okay, the right has done a great job of saying this is moral, this is immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done this with some really terrible issues. You know, homosexuality is immoral. That's just wrong and ridiculous and awful. But they've made a strong claim. And we on the left have been scared to say that corporate control of the media is immoral.
Right.
We've been scared to say, you know, any number of things are immoral, and we need to
step up. I mean, to really to take a stance and really do it strategically, right? I mean, that's where it's been lacking is this strategy of understanding what's going to make a move and go for it.
You raise a huge and important point in that. I mean, let's drop the issue of morality for a second and let's talk about strategy on the left.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What? The left doesn't have any strategy.
No. Because that's at the core values of the left, is to be completely transparent, to be all together in that. But they're in that. It's not looking at the end goal. How do we get there? Let's get a strategy and move on, right? I mean, that's what the right does, and that's why they're so effective.
I agree with you. And part of the problem when it comes to environmental issues is a lot of us, we can't come up with a strategy because we don't really know what we want.
Yeah.
And so consequently, we end up, it's like, you know, Bill McKibben does this all the time. He says explicitly that what he wants to save is civilization. He is not saying he wants to save the oceans. He's not saying that he wants to save bats or birds.
Right.
And the problem is, if you want to save civilization, if you want to save civilization and you want to save the planet too, it can't be done. No strategy can do it because it's civilization that's killing the planet. So first, we need to be clear. What do we want?
Yeah.
What are the things that we want? Okay, I'm going to ask you right now, and I've got answers for this. I've been asked this a bunch of times, but I'm going to ask you, what do you want? I mean, not like right now. What do you want? You don't want a piece of pie,
yeah.
You know, but like
two pieces of pie would be great. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. In fact, you want everybody's pie. Yeah. You're a
capitalist. Yeah. I want all flavors from all stakeholders. No, I would say that I do want to save civilization, but more importantly, I want to create a community-based civilization where it's not just civilization of people, but it's, if you could look at it, the whole world. I mean, because I truly believe, and maybe I am naive, but I really do believe that we can fundamentally add value to ourselves and add value to everything around us and create a happy ecosystem as long as we know the systems and what's killing it and avoid that and be conscious enough to make sure we're not doing that.
How can you do that and still have mining?
Now that's the thing, right? And
yeah, that's the thing.
Okay, so you have to look at the systems of where we already have materials extracted. So first and foremost, the biggest thing would obviously be to use all the materials, find a way to reuse all the materials that we've done and hugely incentivize anything that resembles cradle to cradle. Right?
Okay, the problem is that many problems.
Yeah.
One of them is that the USGS estimates that demand for aluminum, for example, is going to, I believe, almost triple between 2010 and 2025.
I believe it.
Which means even 100% recycling, there'll still have to be bauxite mines. But in addition, a lot of aluminum is used in electronics.
Mm-hmm.
And electronics are an incredibly toxic process to deconstruct.
Yeah.
And then in addition, aluminum recycling itself requires, and the reason I know this is because I got in a big fight with this bright green environmentalist where one of the things he was claiming is that 100% metals recycling is sustainable and possible. And so it's like, wait a second. So I did the research. That's why I don't actually know this stuff. And I didn't know this stuff a year ago. I know it now.
Yeah.
And aluminum recycling requires heating the aluminum to about 650 degrees C.
Right.
How do you do that sustainably?
Exactly.
And then also the process of aluminum recycling gives off all sorts of products like ammonia.
Oh yeah. No. Okay. Well, let me flip this on you. What do you think is going to happen when we run out of aluminum? Do you think electronics, or when we run out of all crucial resources in the land of electronics, do you think that we're going to innovate to a way that we can create more electronics, or do you think that it's going to dissolve and become land-based?
I think that this culture is based entirely, including its tremendous overshoot, is based entirely on oil. And I think oil is the primary one we have to worry about. No, we have the primary one we have to pray runs out, actually. And oil is one, water, soil. I mean, what's his face? Richard Heinberg wrote this great book called Peak Everything.
Yeah. Post-Carbon Institute, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm getting an echo now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me put these headphones on. Maybe that'll help. These unsustainable headphones, greenwashed.
Yeah. Okay, this is much better. Okay, so this culture is, it's far beyond tinkering in order to maintain itself. And in addition, let's look at this from the perspective of coho salmon, or mm-hmm. from the perspective of
anything on the verge of extinction.
Yeah, anybody besides industrial humans.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they would want this to continue,
no.
because it's killing them.
Right.
And so my primary, what I want is to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, more migratory songbirds. And if there's a way to do that with refrigeration, that's fine. But what's primary is the real world. And I've got about 4 or 5 more minutes. So do you want to ask one more question?
Yeah. I mean, I love this really. This is good. Let's move into action, right? First of all, yes or no, do you think that we can correct course in any measurable way?
Who's we?
As society. Say the North America.
As a mass? No.
No? Okay.
No.
Okay. Well, saying that we want to get into second place or do better, what's some strategy that we can really take action? Because if as long as we're going to lose, we might as well try hard.
Well, no, I didn't say we're going to lose. You asked if
American
society
to switch
change course. And I think all we have to do is to look at Obama and to look at the Republican presidential candidates to see that things are not going the right direction. Last year were the highest carbon emissions ever in the history of the planet. I mean, nothing's going the right direction.
Right.
And so then that leads to the question, your next question was, what's a strategy? But we have a question before, which is the one we were just asking, which is, what do you want to save? And if your strategy is you want to make civilization last as long as possible, if that's your goal, your strategy is going to be different than if your strategy is to save the oceans. If your strategy is to save the oceans, or if your strategy is to save forests, then what we need to do is to dismantle civilization.
Yeah.
And what that, there's a lot of emotional work that has to be done. Yes, we have to decolonize our hearts and minds, but in addition, what would we do if space aliens had invaded the planet and space aliens had landed here and they were changing the climate? They were burning oil and gas and changing the climate. And the space aliens were putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk. What would we do?
It'd be easy.
We would attack the source.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's my strategy.
So really have a unbiased view of what's going on.
Well, I think that's really important. Well,
it is.
I don't believe that any such thing as an unbiased view. I don't think that that's possible. I think we all have biases. And my biases are that I want for California red-legged frogs and northern red-legged frogs to continue.
Yeah.
That's my bias. And clearly, there are a lot of people, especially those who are in power, who don't share that bias.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we should have an unbiased perspective. I think what we should do is recognize that the planet is primary and that without a planet, you don't have any economic system.
Right.
That people who come after are not going to care about how innovative we were or how smart or how stupid or how hard we tried. They're not going to care about whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green, whatever. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water.
Yeah.
Those are primary. Water and air and food are primary. And everything else comes from there.
So it's a value shift, or even recognizing that the values are in jeopardy?
It's recognizing that not only values, but life itself is in jeopardy.
Yeah.
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 And I think that's a good note to end on.
Hey, well, thanks for taking the time. The new book, Dreams. Thank you.